Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about water. Now, just think of water for a minute. You can swim in it, you can bathe in it, but perhaps one of the most important things we do with water is drink it. And unless you happen to be living in Flint, Michigan, we assume that the water we drink from a tap is as good as it gets. Well, is that true? Well, today we're going to be talking to Professor Susan Richardson. She's from the University of South Carolina, and she's an environmental scientist specializing, at the moment anyway, in the quality of drinking water. And so, Susan Richardson, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, before we get onto your role as a scientist and making sure that we get a good cup of tea or a cup of coffee, how did you get into this game? When you were a little girl, what were those moments where someone said to you, you should be a scientist, or conversely, dear, you should never be a scientist, you're a little girl, right? And how did you develop into a science career?
I think how I developed into a scientist came down to a wonderful high school chemistry and physics teacher. She was very encouraging, and of course at that time when you're young, I think you have no clue what you're going to do with your life. And she just made chemistry and science come alive to me. And so once I graduated from high school, then I decided, well, maybe I'll give chemistry a try in college. And then went well then, and I had a wonderful chemistry professor who was just life-changing, made it come up really even more alive to me. And then decided to go on to graduate school from there, and then had this wonderful career at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency at one of the national labs. And now I'm in academia at the University of South Carolina. So it's kind of how it happened.
But it sounds seamless. But when you were younger, let's say when you were 7 or 8, did you like science then? Did you go out and collect butterflies or fireflies in the southeast? Were there any things that you did that you can look back on and say, look, it seems I had a taste for this then?
I don't know. You know, I haven't really thought about that too much. But I did like to be outside and to look for things and find things. And one of my big hobbies right now is actually looking for fossils. So that's my big hobby. So I think holding a piece of an ancient animal in your hand has always fascinated me. And so maybe there was a little bit of that going on early on. But it really had to do more with that high school chemistry teacher than anything else, I think.
Well, let's just look at fossil hunting for a moment. I mean, this is not something that you can necessarily do in your backyard. I mean, maybe you can. I don't know quite what South Carolina soil is like and when it was deposited, etc. But do you go on special trips with your family and say, hey, I think we'll go to, I don't know, let's say Cretaceous in North Texas or something? Do you plan holidays?
I do sometimes, as a matter of fact. And so there was a guy at the EPA lab who would come and do sabbaticals he was from upstate New York, and he's the one that first told me about a site on a beach in Florida, Venice, Florida, where you could find all kinds of fossilized shark's teeth, but all kinds of other fossils too, just washed up on the shore, like you find shells. And so that was my first foray in that. And then once you get hooked and you find your first one and then you find 200 of them, then you want to find other places to find things too. And so now we plan our family vacations to Fernandina Beach, Florida, because they're even better, in my opinion, than Venice. And so I found a mammoth tooth lying on the beach. There's not
how,
as many.
How big is that?
This one was actually a mammoth spit tooth, the ones that are like the juveniles that they actually have conveyor belt kind of situations mammoths did for their teeth. And the spit tooth would be one of the ones they rotate out, and they are smaller. So this was a smaller, so maybe 5 inches by four, something like that.
That's a big thing to find on a beach.
Yeah.
Right? And,
yeah.
And realize what it is.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so that's a hobby. And that's a nice hobby to have, because it gets you out of doors, but you also begin to learn about the whole concept of fossils and time periods, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me tell you something interesting, too, along that. One of the big kind of moments of revelation I had. So you find all kinds of things on these beaches that are washed up, mostly from coming out of rivers. And when they dredge rivers, a lot of times they'll come out and wash up on a beach. But one thing I found, the first time I ever found a horse tooth, a fossilized horse tooth, was kind of life-changing, because in school, they always tell you that the Spanish brought the horses to North America, but it takes thousands of years, in fact, hundreds of thousands of years typically, for a tooth to fossilize. And when I held that first fossilized horse tooth, and you could tell what it was. It looks just like a horse tooth today, except it's black or colored, you know, kind of a brown color. And I thought, wait a minute, the Spanish didn't bring the horses over. They were here a long time before. And then, of course, I did some reading and I found out that they were here in North America before the Spanish, but then they went extinct and then the Spanish brought them back.
That's so. Actually a very interesting story, because I don't know what a horse tooth looks like. Well, you're certainly one or two up on me on that respect. Okay, so anyway, you went away, you studied, and you got into analytical chemistry, I guess, using different techniques. Give us a typical technique analytical chemists use.
So the main technique I use is something called mass spectrometry. And so right now I do environmental research, and mass spectrometry is the most sensitive technique to do trace analysis for complex mixtures. And when you have environmental mixtures like drinking water that has a lot of things in it, you need to be able to separate those chemicals and be able to detect them at very low levels. And mass spectrometry is really the state of the art for that.
This is a technique which puts the molecular species into the vapor phase, and then passing through analytical techniques comes out at the other end, and you can say, ha, here's a molecule with a certain molecular weight and it fragments this way, this is what it is, etc., etc. It is incredibly powerful, and you need so little material.
Exactly.
That's the key feature to that. Okay, so then you took that technique and you worked for the EPA. Tell us what you were doing for the EPA.
Yeah, so that's where I got my first start in environmental research. I actually got my PhD at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, in physical organic chemistry. And so I kind of morphed into this environmental analytical chemist that I am today. But I had done some mass spectrometry work as a graduate student at Emory University, and EPA was about to purchase a mass spectrometer just like the one I had used in graduate school. So they hired me on, and I started doing environmental research. And we were doing all kinds of different kinds of samples to begin with, some wastewater, some drinking water, some sludge samples even. And then eventually I got interested in drinking water and the issues that surround, the human health issues that surround drinking water. And that became the path that I wanted to follow.
And of course, these days people are beginning to realize that, you know, whereas maybe 20 years ago, that World War III may begin because of people trying to steal oil wells from one place and take over control. Now it's water that is one of the key areas,
right?
that good potable drinking water is just not that obviously available everywhere. And Canada has a lot. The U.S. hasn't quite as much. And, say, other societies have even less. And so it's a big issue.
It is a big issue. And especially, you know, as our populations are growing, so we've got a lot more wastewater inputs into our rivers that can get into our drinking water supplies. And we have climate change where we've got a lot more droughts. And so we're having to be a lot more creative of where we find our water sources and then how we treat it.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, the old days that, you know, if you were a sooner and you went out to Western Oklahoma and set up your ranch, and then you dig a hole and luckily at some stage you'd find water and that was it, you drink it. Nowadays, it's not quite that simple, all right? And even if we do find water, we're beginning to realize that there's a lot of materials, salts, organics, in water, that perhaps are deleterious to our health. And so that's the key reason that the EPA and yourself, and now as an academic at South Carolina, this is what you're really looking for. What's in our drinking water?
Right.
So run through, without scaring the listener too much, on me either, what are the big issues that one finds in a civilized, highly technically developed country like the USA, which will be different if you were in, say, New Guinea, right?
Right. So, you know, I mentioned we can have some chemicals that come in from our treated wastewater that aren't completely removed in wastewater treatment, can get into our drinking water supplies. But the larger issue to me are the disinfection byproducts that are formed when we treat our water. And so
treating used water, or are we just
used
treating
used water or pristine water? Can be either one.
All right. Mm-hmm. So we disinfect. And how do we do? Mm-hmm. Tell the audience how we What are the general techniques?
Yep. So the different chemical disinfectants we use, chlorine is still very popular. Chloramines has become very popular as well. A lot of drinking water plants have switched to chloramination using chloramines. There's ozone we can treat with. There's also chlorine dioxide. And some plants are even using UV light to help to kill the pathogens. And that's the main reason, you know, that's the reason we're disinfecting, is to kill those harmful pathogens. In the 1800s, millions of people used to die from cholera, typhoid, other waterborne illnesses. So it's extremely important to kill those pathogens or remove them somehow from the water. So we have water that's microbially very safe, so you're not going to get sick from your water. But at the same time, these disinfectants, they're powerful oxidants. And so they'll oxidize that natural organic matter and just other organic things that are in the water and transform that organic matter into these disinfection byproducts. So these disinfection byproducts, we call them DBPs, they aren't there originally in the water, but we cause them to form unintentionally when we treat the water trying to kill the harmful pathogens.
But if you're a chemist, it's not a total surprise. I mean, you've presumably done a few things in the laboratory first and said, well, let's say we've got this particular target molecule that maybe or is in water supplies. Let's do a laboratory examination of what it does, although that's not the way it works then.
We have done a little bit of that, but I can tell you when they first found the first DBPs in drinking water, it was 1974. Wasn't all that long ago.
No.
We were disinfecting water since the late 1800s, and only in 1974 did they discover DBPs. So it was quite a surprise, actually. It's not that the chemists were thinking, oh, there's going to be these DBPs formed in drinking water. It was a big surprise. And now we know that we've identified almost 700 unique chemical DBPs, and we know we're missing a lot. That's the problem. We're still missing a lot. So
let's back off for a minute. I'm kind of intrigued. What was that first seminal paper? Who produced it? Where was it produced? And do you remember the particular chemicals that were involved?
I do. So John Roke, a guy from the Netherlands, from Rotterdam, I believe, and he was working for the Rotterdam Water Treatment Plant, and just a side hobby, he, you know, was a chemist and was analyzing the water and discovered these things called trihalomethanes. And so chloroform, bromoform, bromodichloromethane, chlorodibromomethane, those four are the first ones that were identified. And about 3 months later, I think this work was going on simultaneously, but 3 months later, a group from the US EPA in Cincinnati, Ohio, Tom Beller was the lead author on that paper, discovered the trihalomethanes in the United States as well. So on the heels of the discovery in the Netherlands came one from the US.
So, I mean, that's a simple molecule. And presumably, what we're looking at here, methane for the listener is CH4, natural gas. If you substitute the hydrogens with chlorines, eventually you'll get CCl4, carbon tetrachloride. But if you've still got one hydrogen, that's called chloroform. And it's a widely used chemical reagent in laboratories around the world. Mm-hmm. But it's also not particularly healthy.
Right.
And you can understand in retrospect how chlorination of organics would lead to this as one of the ultimate products.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now, once you've found this, what do we have to do? We've got to get rid of it.
Right. Exactly. That's what I would like to do. And once they discovered these and reported them in 1974, about a year or two later, there was a cancer study done. I forget who did it. But then EPA in 1979, they determined that these were carcinogens. The brominated ones are a lot worse than chloroform. In fact, chloroform is not all that carcinogenic, but it became
just a little bit,
a little bit.
Wonderful. That's reassuring.
Well, the toxicologists say that you have to practically drown the animal, the rat, in chloroform to get the tumors to form. So it's not very carcinogenic. But the US EPA and the Safe Drinking Water Act in 1979 decided to regulate those four, to control the levels of those four in drinking water, trying to protect human health and make it safer.
Okay, well, this is going to get good now, because we're going to go through a litany of what you've tried to do. We have to take a break. This is Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Susan Richardson from the University of South Carolina, environmental scientist. And as you heard, she's really very keen on making sure that the water we drink is as good as it can be. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Susan Richardson from the University of South Carolina, and we're talking about your drinking water. That's the water you just used if you nipped out for a quick cup of tea. Okay, so chloroform, bromoform, these are simple molecules. Presumably now we know how to get rid of them from post-disinfectant treated water.
Not completely getting rid of them, but to lower their levels.
Okay. Well, that's interesting because chemists now have these wonderful techniques, and Susan here is one of these people that's developed them, that we can never get rid of everything. There's always something left. Our measurement techniques are so good, and that may be an issue we come back to in a moment. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a simple question. Ozone is a very nice reactive molecule, an oxidation material, and then these various chloramines and chlorine, etc., also do oxidation. Why don't we just use ozone? Then we wouldn't have the problem of chlorinated products. Yeah. What's the efficiency of chlorine compared to ozone, or vice versa?
This is where it gets a little bit complicated because each disinfectant produces its own suite of disinfection byproducts. There's no silver bullet. They're not immune to them. And so ozone is actually the best disinfectant of all for killing microorganisms. But the big but is if you have salt levels containing sodium bromide in particular, so you can have sodium chloride. We know as salt, if you have sodium bromide present, that bromide can then react with ozone and natural organic matter and form some harmful things, some harmful disinfection byproducts. In fact, one of the ones that EPA added to the regulatory list fairly recently is bromate, called bromate, and it's a potent carcinogen. It's regulated at the lowest level of all of the DBPs that are currently regulated. And so bromate is one of the things you don't want in your drinking water. And also with bromide, you can actually get bromoform, one of the THMs, to form,
okay,
as well as dibromoacetic acid, which is another another regulated DBP. But if you don't have bromide, significant levels of bromide in your water, you're fine, in my opinion, to use ozone. So it really depends on the source water you have. It varies depending on the water you have.
And when people – I know nothing about water treatment. One imagines that you can run water through columns to absorb the nasty things, or you can do other technologies. Is it not easy to remove salts from water?
No, it's not easy. Reverse osmosis is kind of the gold standard,
yes,
for that. There's also electrodialysis, but it takes money. It takes money, and so they say it's expensive to do. But some places have to, and I guess even here in El Paso, you have to because you have salty groundwater,
absolutely,
right? And a lot of places, some places on the coast, too, have saltwater intrusion into their drinking water supplies as well, and they have to use some kind of way to remove the salts.
Yeah, because I thought that the desalination, if you like, which is a sort of a generic term, was relatively simple. But your point is it's a feature of how much money you want to spend for the return that you get.
Exactly. Because we could probably remove 99% of all these chemicals if we wanted to, but it's just a matter of cost. And so consumers don't want their water bill to be extraordinarily high. You know?
So the bottom line is that it's this delicate balance between risk and cost. It's rather like, you know, I suppose if you want to make sure you're never in an accident, you'd never get in your car and drive anywhere. And yet we take that risk.
Right.
We get into airplanes. We take that risk. Mm-hmm. We go on trains. Everything we do, I wander into my laboratory. I'm taking a risk, especially if I'm not wearing, you know, if I'm wearing sandals. But in general, what's your current feeling in America, with North America, that where we are on this risk and cost feature? Are we going to carry on and on and on, or does there come a point where we say, look, this is okay. You can drink the water containing this amount of this, 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 and the other without going to bottled water, which presumably is the gold standard, but I'm not even sure about it. I remember when Perrier water, and they found benzene in Perrier water. That was a big shock.
Mm-hmm. And they found bromate in, I think it was Dasani water from the UK a while back, too. And that's because they were adding minerals back, which you need to
right,
to highly purified water. But they added the minerals before they ozonated, and that was a mistake, forming bromate.
That's a big mistake.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, you yourself, you're an expert in the field, and you've got a family. Do you drink tap water, or do you actually have a stash of bottled water?
I only drink bottled water when I'm out and about. Essentially, we have a choice between soft drink and bottled water. So I don't buy bottled water for the home. And I would say I would drink the water anywhere in the U.S. But if I live in particular places, I would have a filter on my home tap probably. And in fact, I do have a filter on my home tap now where I'm located currently, just because we have fairly high levels of bromide and also high levels of iodide, and we haven't talked about those yet. But the disinfection byproducts that we've identified that were unknown before, the ones that contain iodine are a little bit more toxic than ones that contain bromine. And so actually, I do filter my tap. But it really depends where you are. Where I used to live in Georgia, didn't need to do that. And so, and of course, if you have a lead situation like they do in Flint or like they do in some other cities, you know, by gosh, I for sure would have a filter on my tap.
Well, I mean, now you've brought up all sorts of interesting things. First of all, let's go to the iodine. As group 17 of the periodic table is fluorine at the top, chlorine, bromine, and iodine. They're the key elements. Where does the iodine come from? Is that also that there are salts native to the water, which is where the iodine comes from, or are we bringing the iodine in from some other industrial or personal usage?
That's a really good question. I would say we think that the largest source of iodine is just the salt. So just like you have sodium chloride, you have sodium bromide, you're going to have sodium iodide. Those go hand in hand. All three of those are almost always present together. The chloride is present a lot higher levels than bromide, and bromide's a lot higher levels than the iodide. So iodine's not huge levels, but enough to form these toxic iodinated DVPs if you have the iodide get into your source water. But we also have a study that project we've been working on, published some data on this, that we've discovered that these compounds used for medical imaging also have iodines in their structure. They have three iodines on a benzene ring with some other groups. And in fact, if you get those medical imaging compounds coming into your drinking water supply from treated wastewater, come in your drinking water supply, we see that we can form those iodinated DVPs when those are treated with either chlorine or chloramines.
Let's be, if you can, specific, not too technical, but DPBs is a disinfectant byproducts, mm-hmm. iodinized or iodinated or whatever. Mm-hmm. Give me an example.
Mm-hmm. Iodoacetic acid, very simple
acetic
molecule.
Acid, that's vinegar.
Right.
Right. So right. You put an iodine on there, and all of a sudden that is a nasty toxic material or some description?
It's the most genotoxic of all DBPs studied to date, much more so than the ones we regulate. So it's not regulated, not looked for anywhere, and it can be there in some drinking water supplies.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Chloroacetic acid is well known, but I've never heard of anyone actually talking about iodoacetic acid. Mm-hmm. And that's a relatively simple molecule.
Mm-hmm. Very simple. So it was pretty simple to identify.
Right.
We first identified it in 2004, and then we had a large occurrence study in 2008 where we took 23 cities across the U.S. and one large city in Canada and quantified the levels of that chemical, iodoacetic acid, along with a few other iodoacids that we identified. There were five of them we had identified, and also iodotrihalomethane. So like chloroform, if you substitute one of the chlorines with an iodine, you can have these six iodinated ones.
These are much more genotoxic. Is that because, from what little I know, the carbon-iodine bond is much weaker?
Right.
And therefore can generate radicals or something that then do nasty things to...
Yep.
Well, I was just going to take a mouthful of water, too. I think I still will. So that's one area. Let's go to Flint. That's a topical area at the moment, and that's really all about lead. But it's not that the lead is indigenous, if you like, to the water. It's that the water was, as I understand it, somewhat acidic, mm-hmm. right? And that caused corrosion of lead pipes. Mm-hmm. So that's another area for introduction of nasties into our drinking water.
Correct, yeah.
How do we get around that one, apart from making sure that the incoming water is about as neutral mm-hmm. as possible, mm-hmm. or digging up all the old pipes?
Mm-hmm. It's tricky. So what happened in Flint, they also had pretty high levels of chloride, salt, sodium chloride in their water as well, making it corrosive. So it's a combination of the lower pH and something like 8 times the amount of chloride that you normally would have in a water supply. But the major thing there is it's always wise to pick your best water source that you can. They had Lake Huron, which is a really good water source. Those Great Lakes are great water supplies, and they should have never changed. That's the bottom line. Pick a really good quality water source, and you'll have the least amount of problems, I think. But if you have an impacted source like that, so say you only had the Flint River and, you know, a situation like that, then what they should have done and what they were doing for a while was adding orthophosphate, corrosion inhibitor. A lot of plants around the country are doing that to form a coating inside the pipes to keep that lead from leaching out. And so they did it for a little while, is my understanding, in Flint, and then they stopped doing it. Who knows why? And that's when
that's, again,
all the lead.
Probably cost. I mean, people usually, especially when you're running an operation of that magnitude, cost, we're going back, risk-cost assessment.
Mm-hmm. But that's a cost you want to pay.
Absolutely.
And I know that the EPA recommends that, and I believe Veolia, the water company, was recommending that too. So it's strongly recommended to do that.
Susan, do you have one last word that you'd care to say?
Sure. I would just like to say that, my whole goal is to make drinking water as safe as possible. And we have a lot of challenges with our water system, but I feel confident that we have a lot of very smart people in this country, and we're a developed nation, and we can come out with better ways to make our water even safer.
Well, you heard it here on Science Studio. You heard it from the mouth of Professor Susan Richardson from the University of South Carolina. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together. And the listeners out there, of course, as always, without listeners, there's no program. Take care, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.